a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. Well, hi folks, this is Jack Spirko with the Survival Podcast. Welcome to an episode of Friday Flashbacks. After 15 years and hundreds of interview shows, we decided to run them as flashbacks every Friday. Beginning with the oldest of them and going forward, there's a tremendous library of wisdom in all the great interviews we've done over the years. So sit back and enjoy. Whether this is your first time or even your second time around with today's episode, I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn a lot from it. And remember, you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work we do just by becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Members Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get access to over 70 awesome discount codes on products and services you likely already use. Things like seeds, cannabis products, food storage items, custom roasted coffee, and even cool stuff like ammo and moonshine stills and more. So support the show, get all your money back and more. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more and sign up. Now let's get into today's Friday Flashback. Today we are flashing back to March the 23rd, 2011, all the way back to what was originally episode 630, and this title was Mike Gazer on the Current Economy and Everyday Prepping. Mike's one of the most switched-on financial minds I know. I think it'll be interesting for you to listen to him assess the economy in 2011. And one thing I want you to think of, I believe this is the episode where he talked about tying up the boat. A lot of gains happened in the market since this and continue on today, but the interim between this time and when that began was pretty good, and his whole point with that was that you need to wait till signals say we're done washing out. The other thing I want you to really focus on, this more than his financial advice, is Mike. You know, Mike's one of those guys that has been successful enough in what he does in the world of economics, as an investor and as a commentator, that he doesn't need any money. I'm pretty sure he still doesn't need any money, and I haven't caught up with Mike in about 5 years, so I don't know if maybe something happened to him. I haven't heard anything, you know, like bad happen or anything. He was still a prepper. He built a really great property that we talk about in this episode on not that much land up in New England, and this was a really great interview, and I think this is the interview that I actually had to do twice. Because something happened when we finished the first interview and the whole file got wiped out. And it was really a difficult thing to reach out to him because of the level this guy was, especially for this time in TSP. You know, today I have quite a bit of cloud out there. Back when we did this in 2011, the show was really growing and all, but it was hard to get a guest of this level on the show. And Mike was like, yeah, we'll do it again, no problem. So really good guy. Really switched on guy, great interview, tons of wisdom that still apply today, 13 years later. And here we go, let's flash back, episode 603, Mike Gazer on the Current Economy and Everyday Prepping. All right, folks, as I said, it's my good pleasure to welcome back to the show Mike Gazer. Mike, of course, being one of the guys I consider to be one of the most financially switched on guys there is out there, with a lot of inside information financially, and also quite a bit of a homesteader. So we have him on to talk about all kinds of stuff with us today, some of the economic factors that are going on out there, and some of the stuff he's doing at his little homestead up there in Connecticut. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Jack, you know I love it. Good to be here.
Well, hey, I wanted to kind of get off on a subject right away that everybody seems to be really thinking a lot about right now, and they're thinking about it in ways that I've done enough episodes recently where I basically said, calm down, don't panic. But, of course, it's the tsunami slash earthquake slash nuclear meltdown in Japan. And I think there's a lot of hype around this right now with, you know, people, you and I were talking offline about people paying $100 for a bottle of iodide, and stuff like that. But I'm actually concerned long term about the financial implications here. Do you have any thoughts on that?
You know, that's a very timely topic, Jack. And the thing is, will there be economic impact? The answer is yes, because clearly I heard this morning that Toyota is bringing a plant that it had offline back online. But clearly, industry, Japan is the third largest economy in the world, barely third. China just recently passed it. And this is slowing them way, way down. So that's just bad for a global economy, which now I don't believe, honestly, that we were really accelerating out of any real recession here. But when you've got one of the world's biggest economies devastated, you know, geographically, physically devastated, like Japan is right now, that's not good for the world's economy. So there's no even negotiating that. Is it really going to affect the U.S. economy? I'm not sure. Small parts, people forget that a lot of, well, not a lot, almost everything that we use today, this phone I'm talking to you on, hotel doors, all have these microscopic computer chips in them. A lot of those are manufactured in Japan, including even those flash memory cards you use in your digital camera and elsewhere. There's going to be pockets. Devastating, I don't know, but we were in a fairly precarious situation before this whole thing even happened, so this doesn't help. I've heard people try to argue it'll be good for the Japanese economy, which has been really sucking it for 20 years. But, I mean, yes, they do have to do a lot of rebuilding, but there's also the people that think World War II got the U.S. out of the Depression. It was somewhat helpful, but these are not always that productive of things, rebuilding stuff that was already fine in the first place, which is effectively what the Japanese situation is. We'll put some people to work, but I, you know, any sensible person would say that's kind of a waste of money.
Agreed. One thing I've had a couple of people bouncing off me, and I want your take on this, because I think it's being well overblown by people that want to sound intelligent right now, but it's that, you know, obviously one concern we have is Japan is one of a very large group of holders of large amounts of U.S. treasuries, and that they'll have a need for cash here, which means they may go and dump a bunch of their treasuries. Do you think that could be enough to be really significant when we look at, you know, holders like the U.K. and holders like China and what have you that already are holding gobs of this stuff anyway?
The direct answer is yes, they are going to sell some. Big impact, I don't know actually right now. It's not good in a supply and demand market if the Japanese start selling off some U.S. Treasury bonds, which is how the U.S. borrows their money. It's going to drop the price and raise rates. Significantly, I don't know, and it's probably a whole other show for you and me to do, Federal Reserve, talking about quantitative easing 3, because since I talked to you last, they've already snuck 2 in there, and 3 seems to be like on the table for any moment. So that could help pick up the slack of the Japanese selling some, but I don't know. I'm not yet in the camp of panicking, ready to jump off a bridge over the devastation that it could cause. They're going to need some money. They got to invest it home. They're going to have to sell some. But how bad? I don't think so. Not too bad.
Yeah, I think there's a lot left to be seen, too. I mean, we do have to realize that as bad as this looks on our TVs, it's a relatively small piece of Japan. It's not like this happened in downtown Tokyo. And, I mean, you can look at the United States coming back from 9/11, for instance. And I think their disaster has a greater toll on life and property, but I don't know that it would be that much bigger of an impact on the economy of the country as a whole. So, you know, I think we've seen nations hit like this come back and put things back together in the past.
And Japan, whatever Americans want to think of them, the Japanese are a very dignified, hardworking, we're all in it together type of group. You even watched, I mean, I've seen so many what appear to be senior citizens just not only cleaning up their own properties, taking it upon themselves to fix their own problem. I mean, the Japanese are going to come out of this better than damn near any other country on earth, and probably will come up with some breakthrough technologies thanks to it. That's what they've always been good at. The United States, we would invent something, like come up with some idea. The Japanese would just take that idea, make it better, faster, and whatnot. I can't imagine this is going to be different than that.
Yeah, the other thing I think that we might see out of this is that Maybe, I don't know what I'm trying to say here. The entire focus right now is, you know, how devastated these guys are and how this is like going to be a forever thing to rebuild. But what you're talking about with that ethic there and just the mentality of the Japanese people, I said this on the air last week. I bet you that they will have things pretty much back to normal as can be the case, because there might be some spots that are like irradiated for a long time that are, you know, have to be walled off. But other than that, I think they'll be back on their feet before we put a tenant into the new World Trade Centers. A single tenant conducts a single day's worth of business there. I do understand they're up to like the 50th floor now on one of the new towers, but I mean, my God, we've been playing with that for 10 years. I think they'll come back from this quicker than we came back from 9/11.
I could not agree with you more. Of all societies on Earth, none has a better temperament and work ethic to do that than the Japanese. So, I'm encouraged. It saddens me, but you know what's interesting? I don't even remember how long ago Haiti was. Everybody that I talked
just over
to,
a year, just over
and,
a year.
And you're talking about 50 stories. I don't think anyone is out of their tent in Haiti yet. I don't get me going on that. Where did all that money go, man? That's what I want to know.
Well,
where did that money?
Well, I can tell you where some of it didn't go, and that was Haiti. I don't know. You don't listen to the show all the time, but there was a guy that I had on here named Brandon that set up his own little nonprofit. He's a paramedic out of Florida, and they were on the ground in Haiti like 3 days after the initial earthquake. And he's been back like 5 or 6 times, and they're down there saving lives. And basically he's saying, every $4 I get my hands on, I save a kid's life because of diarrhea medication. And that's what these kids are dying of down there now. And he told me that there was like, I can't remember the number, but it was some ungodly amount of money the Red Cross took in. And this is a guy that's been on the ground there repeatedly. And he said, and I quote, "I have never seen a Red Cross tent in Haiti. I have never seen any evidence. I saw one bundle of blankets that came from the Red Cross in multiple trips," where he's out seeking the worst areas impacted. And the way he had put it, he said, if you could have took Haiti, I think it was like $90 million. He said, you could have took Haiti and cut it up into 90 little squares and gave every square $1 million and done more than the Red Cross will ever do there. So, yeah, I'm telling people to help out in Japan right now, but I hate to say this, but I'm telling them not to do it through the Red Cross.
Well, there was a lot of money raised from that George Clooney telethon and Wyclef Jean, who got shot or stabbed or whatever just the other day, which I'm waiting to hear more on that. But I remember numbers well in excess of $100 million, which, you know, I don't know Haiti that well, but God almighty, I would think that would rebuild the whole damn thing.
I would think you could almost buy Haiti for $100 million. The whole landmass. It's not that big a place. I do want to shift a little bit with you now, though. I do want to talk a little bit about the current economy. The current is you and I both agree kind of a false recovery, but we have had some differences on this. I said when I had you on the air last time that the Dow was going to hit 12.5. You said that the recovery was over. You hoped it got out. I almost got there, and it retreated back, but. I actually see this thing somewhat sustained. I know what you're going to say. The fundamentals haven't changed. The underlying problems are still there, and I agree. But I think that the PR campaign has some success left in it. Am I still wrong?
This is always a frustrating thing for an old bond market guy like me. No, the fundamentals aren't there. No, I don't believe the recovery was ever real. It's a public relations campaign. Since you and I spoke the last on the air, let's pick a state. What do you want? California, Illinois, Wisconsin, New Jersey, Connecticut, New York. It's one train wreck after another being papered over with more debt. They're kicking the can down the road. And the problem I have in these kinds of conversations is the stock market does not have to be rational. It has not been rational. But I don't know when the check comes. It's been quite a party. Everyone's been having plenty of drinks, and it's all a really good time. But, I mean, these bills have to get paid. Any American, anybody listening to the show right now knows one thing. If I ask them what caused this problem, they'd say in a word, debt. Too much debt. Well, you know what? I don't know why Americans aren't thinking about it or talking about it, but do you know how much more debt we're in right now than we were in 2007? Trillions of dollars more debt at every level. You know, consumers have not done much with paring down their own personal debts. Corporations are in plenty of debt. The municipalities and federal governments are a nightmare. Never mind Ireland, Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal. Don't get me started. Ireland is moments away from being done. Put a fork in them. So I don't know when anyone's going to face the fact that something's going to happen. Massive tax increases, brutal cuts in services, or just outright defaults on all this stuff, which means the pension funds, insurance companies, and whomever else owns all this debt, they're going to be sucking it too. So, I mean, you can keep kicking the can, but man, oh man, that check, the waiter always shows up at the end of the night with a check.
I agree with that. I think you and I were talking about this before. We said the people that ran up the check, they're going to be in the men's room climbing out the window when the check gets here.
Sure.
They're not going to pay it.
Right, and their kids and grandkids are the ones at the table.
You know, I did an article back in December. I called Seven Deadly Cracks on the False Recovery. And kind of like two that are almost the same, but they are different, that I want to get your take on, because you're bringing some of it up here. And I think it's where we might see this check start to come due, is at the state and the city level. We've got cities and states across America that are, for all intents and purposes, they are bankrupt. But they're hanging on right now. But I put it this way on the air, Mike. I said, you know, when we heard, you know, Portugal's in trouble or Greece is in trouble, look, the market tumbles, everybody starts freaking out. What do you think is going to happen one day when somebody actually has to come on TV and say, the governor of California or the governor of the state of New York says that the state of New York is bankrupt? I mean, right. That's got to have a much bigger impact than freaking Portugal or Greece.
Well, California all by themselves, their economy is bigger than Australia's, just them. So something, and the problem they have, what is impressive, I guess, is the fact the only reason they're still open for business right this minute is because the bond market investors are still willing to lend them money. That's how they're papering over these gigantic budget gaps. Like, you know, to move it right to the federal level, I heard, you know, of course we have the new Congress, yada, yada, and they're gonna talk tough and cut things. But when they immediately take, all the sort of, mandates and the defense budget, so Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, welfare, federal pensions, and the military off the table, that leaves 15% of the federal budget. And if they actually cut out that entire, if they just eliminated that 15%, what most Americans don't realize is the budget still wouldn't be balanced this year.
It would never be balanced that way. What you're saying is the only thing that they're talking about cutting is the discretionary spending, and the non-discretionary is 80% or more of the budget. And they're looking at that like a poison pill, like we can't touch it, but that's where you got it. I mean, I guess I'll put it this way. If you have a household and they're in chaos and they know they have to cut expenses, the very first thing the household looks at is what are our biggest expenses, and our government's doing the complete opposite. They're saying what are our smallest expenses.
Right, and negotiating those. And I love the fact that, like, they get, you know, the government gets, the Republicans get their panties a bunch, and they're going to cut NPR, which I don't listen to NPR. So if they cut it, I don't really even care. But you know what? It's a rounding error in the scope of the federal government's budget. It's stupid. It gets attention. They have these little films of this dope talking about the Tea Party. I mean, you know, I could care less about public radio or public television, honestly, because I don't watch it or listen much. But Americans get caught up, and the politicians know that Americans are listening. That it's about time we cut funding for Big Bird. Okay, knock yourself out, man. Cut it.
I'm fine with not paying for Big Bird anymore. I really don't want to. I would be happy about that. But Big Bird isn't bankrupting the country.
No, Big Bird's around you. You don't even notice. you know, there's more money than that lost in the sofa cushions at the Pentagon.
We feed the guy birdseed. I mean, come on. It's not going to solve our issues. The one that got me is we're at a $3-point-something-trillion deficit. And they're fighting over cutting $100 billion, and $100 billion to you and me, that's a lot of money. I'd like $100 billion if you got an extra $100 billion on you, Mike. Send it on over. But when we look at what that actually represents to the total budget, it's one of those points in that 3-point-something trillion. There's a thousand billion in a trillion. And they're going to cut $100 billion from $300,000 billion? I mean, it's just... And then people actually think this is a big deal, and they're going to actually have a fight about it for us. And I think that fight is nothing but PR.
But you know what? I've got to write about this in a more profound, detailed way. I think the collective attitude, as I'm starting to sense it, like in the American public... Everyone knows somebody who was, you know, the people that they know they're going bankrupt. You know what I'm saying? They just know it. They're going to lose their house. They're going bankrupt. They're just screwed. And their attitude flips over where they actually go on a little, like, almost drunken spree of their own. Might as well charge up the cards.
Screw it. I'm not going to pay it anyway. I know a guy personally that is getting ready to declare bankruptcy. And his bankruptcy attorney told him, while your credit's still good, go out and buy a really expensive car because you don't owe enough to pull off a good bankruptcy right now. You need to increase your debt before we declare.
Right. And that's I think, the you know, Americans' collective attitude is, you know what? We're already broke. You don't really get broker. We're already bankrupt. You don't get bankrupter. So screw it, you know, $3 trillion, $2 trillion, $1 trillion, $1 million, who the hell cares? It's, you know, we're all screwed, you know, so I think that's the attitude. So
might as well enjoy it on the way.
Sure.
Hangover, you know, it's like, I guess it's when you're on like your eighth highball of the night. You know the hangover's going to suck, but it's already going to suck, so go ahead and order another round.
Let's do it, sure. Yeah, this is fun.
So, I mean, what do you think... You know, obviously neither one of us are such, if either one of us were so good at timing that we could tell you exactly when this is going to happen, we'd have that $100 billion, right? So
yeah.
we can't say exactly when, but when this starts to fall apart, what do you think it looks like? Do you see it like starting at the municipality level and the state level and working its way up? What do you see happen to the country when this check does come due and we can't punt again?
Here are the facts as I see them. The money is going to run out. Where the first domino to go over, I don't know. But here are the facts as we know them. A gigantic amount of municipalities, small, medium, and large, states, are all in very big trouble. They all owe more than they really can afford to pay. Wisconsin was a microcosm of you know, there's a lot of states in worse shape than Wisconsin. Wisconsin just got a lot of news. But the problem, and this is what I don't know, when you move it up to the national level, you know, United States first, I already brought up Ireland, Greece, Portugal, Spain, somebody's going to end up defaulting. You know, and that's just inevitable. Somebody's going to be unable to pay. And what I'm concerned with, there's a few things here. Number one, I don't think politicians of either side, or Tim Geithner at the Treasury or Bernanke at the Federal Reserve, I don't think they believe for a minute there's enough political will to bail anybody else out. If California suddenly needed something, or New York, or Illinois, or name whoever you want, I can't imagine the politicians all folding it back in like they did for TARP and just saying, okay, a trillion, let's just do it. We can't let California fail. And the other thing with the failing, I mean, every American heard about the companies that were too big to fail. Oh, that was a real problem. Well, we have less companies now than we did. I mean, Bear Stearns is gone. Lehman is gone. Merrill Lynch is effectively gone. They've been sucked.
Their market segment is gone. Have you seen an investment banker lately?
Well, but here's the problem. Let's remember Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, Morgan Stanley. I mean, every big investment bank, quote unquote, is not an investment bank. They're all commercial banks and all members of the Federal Reserve and all able to borrow literally infinite amounts of money from the Fed, which, you know, is going to be end up bailed by taxpayers too if something happens. Infinite amounts of money at effectively 0% interest. And how do you let them go now? Because you couldn't let them go before, and we had more companies to spread the risk. So if one of them did go, well, there was at least others to pick up the slack. Well, there's less now. How can you let them go now?
Well, you keyed me in on this, too. The other thing about that is they're basically getting this faucet of free money from the Fed, and they're taking that money, and what they're doing with it is they're going back to the Treasury and buying U.S. Treasuries with the money from the Fed. So it's kind of like it's quantitative easing infinity that they're hiding. Because if I said to you, Mike, I'll tell you what, I'll give you all the money you want, tax free or interest free. How much would you want? You take as much as you could carry,
and then I could lend it back to you and charge you 3% interest.
I mean, that's the biggest scam on the planet. I hope people understand what you're talking about here. You want to explain that a little bit? Because I've been screaming it since I first heard it from you, and people are telling me it can't happen that way.
No.
It's impossible. Bullshit, it's happening. Tell them what's going on here.
It is actually, people, I'm flattered when they think that it can't be this easy. If you are a large commercial bank, like the ones I just mentioned, those are the members of the Federal Reserve. Americans have heard of the discount rate. You know, the Federal Reserve is changing the discount rate. Quite simply, the discount rate is the interest rate that commercial banks can borrow from the Federal Reserve. And that's what all the banks I mentioned can do, borrow from the Federal Reserve at effectively, right now anyway, 0%. What they have been doing now, going on 2.5 years, is borrowing from the Federal Reserve. So the Federal Reserve prints the dollars, lends them to the large banks at effectively 0%, just fractions higher, minuscule. But they take the borrowed money, the commercial banks do, lend it to the U.S. Treasury, the United States government. They buy 5- and 10-year Treasury notes, which currently are yielding in the order of 2.5% to 3.5%. And that's the end of the story. It's a very incestuous, circuitous situation. You borrow from the Fed, lend it to the U.S. government, and it's like the shampoo bottle tells you. Rinse and repeat. So commercial banks, my most recent newsletter, and people, if they want my newsletter, just go on my website, just Google Mike Gasior, G-A-S-I-O-R. You'll get 180,000 results. But you'll find my newsletter easily. But the
And I'll put it in the show. I'll put your site and your newsletter links and all in show notes today.
There you go. And I sent you that newsletter. Didn't I? Socially useless. That was the title of my newsletter. That's my opinion on the commercial and investment banking industry right now. They no longer serve any useful social purpose at all. It was one thing when, you know, Jack Spirko had a few extra $1,000 because he'd saved his money for his whole life. And he's got it in the bank, and the bank is paying him some amount of interest rate. But then Mike Gasior wants to open a hot dog cart business, and I need to borrow some money. So I go down to the bank, and the bank's paying Jack 4%, and the bank would lend me the money and charge me 7%. And that is socially viable. Jack's making a few bucks, you know, for being a good American, saving his money, earning some interest.
Mike's selling some hot dogs and building a business and creating an economic boost, and then the bank gets a few bucks, and everybody's kind of an equal partner in the arrangement. They're making a profit on my money, I'm giving it to them for a profit, and they're loaning it to you, hopefully, so you can go make a profit.
That's good. It's good business. The bank makes some dough. Jack's making some dough. Mike's growing the economy. You know, as an American, I would support the government. When I say be involved, well, FDIC insurance is nice, and making sure that the bank is regulated so they don't get out of hand, that's nice too. You know, fair is fair. But at least there's a socially viable reason for that bank to exist. For the bank instead, because ask anybody listening, ask any friend of yours who runs their own business how it's been getting credit from a bank lately, and prepare yourself for a long night. Banks aren't doing it. They're doing what I just told you they do. Borrow from the Federal Reserve at zero.
But that can't be true. That can't be true, because Bernanke said the whole point of this quantitative easing was to shove money into the bank so they would loan it into our economy. So you're telling me the chairman of the Fed is lying?
Yes. Next question.
So Mike, let's say I get some good news today. You know, an uncle I never really knew happened to drop over dead and leave me $1 million. And of all the people I know, you're the most switched on financially guy I know. So I call you up and say, I just came into a windfall of $1 million. What do I do with my money in this current market? Well, where would you tell me to put that? I know you're not a financial advisor per se in that type of thing, but just one friend to another, you know, what do you think I should do?
Well, the first thing you should do is obviously buy me a nice big steak dinner. But
done.
But while we're eating the steak dinner, then I would probably tell you, this is more wisdom, and I want people just to consider the wisdom of it. And this is me watching the markets for 30 years, because the markets are mean, they're cruel, and the thing is, right now cash is paying you nothing. I mean, short-term interest rates on a money market account it's nauseating. That is forcing people to go, I would say, to places they probably aren't as comfortable with, but feel they have no choice. If I get a 5-year CD, I can at least get 3. If I buy IBM stock, I'll get X percent dividend. And that's all fine and dandy, but the thing is, it's like everything in life. If stuff seems to, and hard to believe, 3% would be too good to be true. But cash is at least paying a positive number. And I think I've said this every time I've been on the show. I've never seen so many different ways as right now to get your kneecaps broken. You can get your kneecaps broken in gold, in oil, in grains, in stocks. God almighty, if you're in the bond market and rates start to climb, I mean, you're just going to be toasty then. I've never seen so many different ways to get busted up. And if cash looks like the last thing you should do, I'm not saying necessarily put it in mayonnaise jars and bury it in your yard, but that ain't bad. I don't buy into all this precious metals and all this other nonsense. This is an enormously, It's a very powerful inflection point where I feel something is going to happen. Not to like use the earthquake analogy, but I feel that pressure building up, and something's going to have to give. And think of all the things that almost did it recently. The Japanese thing really started to send the markets into the crapper. Libya, Egypt, Bahrain. I mean, there's a lot of pressure. At the moment, I think, in the markets and in the economy. Nothing is mechanically or structurally fixed. And I don't know what it is that's going to set the torch. But I just get that. That's just gut instinct on my part. Something's due to happen. And when
I know you're not big on gold, but don't you see some level of safety with some small portion of a person's wealth in gold right now? Because all these things you're telling me about basically say the dollar is dead. Sooner or later, we're gonna end up with just a tanked currency, and at that point, is not a few ounces of gold better than some worthless paper?
Well, so here's the thing, though. See, this is, you know, now you're drawing the economist in me out of the, I try very hard not to be the lectury academic here. But the fact is, okay, the dollar goes in the crapper, not to get all technical on you, hope I'm not talking over everyone's head, but the dollar's in the crapper, hyperinflation perhaps, and now, gold goes from, where is it, about 1400? It's $3,000.
Yep. Okay.
Okay. Okay. Just let's pick something. What costs $1,400 right now? Nice LED TV, maybe? Nice,
sure.
55 inch?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, if the dollar's in the crapper, the Vizio TV is going to be $3,000.
Okay.
And your ounce of gold is $3,000.
Okay.
So, you know, we're always measuring the relative value of the gold by the amount of dollars or yen or pounds or euros it can buy.
Let me put it to you this way, though. I completely agree with you. I do not see metal as a long-term profit play. I see it more as an insurance play, because you could say that, but if I sit on $1,400 in cash, when that TV costs me $3,000, I can only buy half the TV. And if I'm holding gold, now I can buy at least the whole TV.
I hear you. But the fact of the matter is, I mean, would anybody be shocked if gold suddenly dropped back to $1,000, how long ago was it across $1,000? It's within a year, right?
No, you're preaching to the choir here. I'm iffy on gold purchasing right now.
I'm not big on selling it either.
You know, I know you never like. You don't like it was $300, and you don't like it now that it's $1,400.
I find people just too hardcore on everything. They're too hardcore on whatever their thing is. They're too hardcore on gold. They're too hardcore on oil. They're too hardcore. Your question was fine.
Yeah.
Is it smart to have some of? Oh, okay, sure. It's as good as anything else. It's as good as oil. It's as good as stocks. It's as good as corn. It's as good as coal. You know, whatever. But it just is. But people that really like it, they think that should be the de facto currency.
Oh, we completely agree there, Mike. I have no illusions of gold being the quote answer. I know you're not much bigger on silver. I'm a little bit more silver friendly right now than gold friendly. But I know what you're saying. All of these things are mitigated because even with the, you know, you're a financial guy, and I bring you on here to talk about money, but I also bring you on here to talk about things like homesteading, because there's only so much we can do with money right now. You know,
there's, I agree.
You know, we can't. So, I mean, but I guess my bigger question, though, is what do I do with my $1,000,000? Is would $10,000 worth of gold be a good idea? Would I just sit on it? Do I?
I didn't answer the question. If you said you were going to have $1,000,000, okay, here we go. I'd put $250,000 into a money market account. I might put $50,000 into gold, which is now we're at $300,000. I might take another $200,000 and actually put it in stocks, just in case you and I both don't know jack. No pun intended. The other $500,000 I would put in CDs, ladder them. I'd buy $100,000 worth of 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 year, and 5 year CDs. That way, if interest rates were to snap on you, you would immediately have another $100,000 coming due a year from now. That would sort of well position you. You'd have half of it in fixed income, the CDs. You'd have a little bit of it in gold, as much as I could stomach to say. You'd have some of it in stocks, you know, just in case that we don't know what the hell we're talking about. And cash money, cash is king, baby. So that's, you know.
No, I like that. And that's kind of where I wanted you to get to for people, because I want people to understand that just because they hear me on the air and hear me say, you know, having some precious metals, I'm not one of these gold freaks either, Mike, that says, you know, like, you know, and take all your money. I've heard advice that's just miserable, like clean out your IRA and buy gold and bury it in your backyard. And I think that's just terrible, terrible advice. But you do some things outside of the financial world to be self-sufficient, self-reliant as well. I mean, people see your website, you've got your big boat and all, your yacht, and they think maybe you're just a money guy. But you actually have a pretty nice place you've set up there in Connecticut. Can we talk about that for a bit?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know what's funny? I was doing an interview just the other day, and this came up. I think the way it was asked of me, because the homesteading, if you will, preparedness thing came up, and the question was put to me, like, are New Englanders just better at it than others? And I'm saying that because the winter that we just experienced, and I think I told you recently, there was 108 inches of snow at my house this year. I've got 200 acres. About 185 of it is woodland. You know, in New England, like, I have a garden. I have a lot of things. I have a 35-tree orchard. I've got a very sizable strawberry and raspberry patch. My garden's fairly good sized, and this year I'm going to raised beds. I just finished my maple syrup, actually, just last weekend. Not this weekend, the weekend a week ago. 3 gallons this year. Good stuff. Mike Gazier, grade A medium amber. Back to the New England thing is... It's pretty normal where I have lived, you know, basically my whole life, to have a garden. Now, some people have bigger ones. Some people just have a few tomato plants and a few peppers, but that's just how we do it. And 108 inches of snow, well, you know, we don't have earthquakes or tsunamis or, you know, hurricanes are sort of cute. They break some limbs and stuff. But we're ready because you better be ready. If you ain't ready, man,
I was going to say, that's 9 feet of snow, and I think that maybe people in northern climates, it's not maybe they're better at it. I think more people actually do something, though, because
you got to, because
there's no choice. It's not, well, there might be an earthquake in the next 5 years. This is going to be a winter every year.
Every year. Yeah, and it was snowing. I had an inch of snow at my house today, this morning. So, and we had several power outages. One lasted 48 hours, and I have, as you and I have discussed on other shows, I've got multiple generators. I've got a 15,000-watt propane one wired into the house. I've got 200-gallon, not 100-pounders, 100-gallon tanks of propane to run that. I heat the house and my pool with wood. I got more wood than Saudi Arabia's got oil, so screw them. You know, I wish I could burn, you know, if I could only burn wood in my Suburban, I'd be all set. But you know what's funny is this whole preparedness, homesteading thing, I never thought of that. This is just crap I'm supposed to do. That's how you better be ready. You know?
I think that would be the case if people like you were the norm, though. And I think that even 25 years ago, it was more normal for people to be doing the types of things you're doing. Today, and it seems like we're moving further and further and further away from that, and I think it's because people have believed that the number of dollars was your preparedness. That's your security blanket is money. I think we even have had financial advisors, or as I call them, financial liars, training people that your security is all about your magic number or whatever crap they come up with, but you can't eat money.
No, but I think, you know, even the sort of hipster types, there was an article, where did I see it? It was this weekend, in one of the newspapers, weekend magazines, about the whole recycling thing being really sort of the bastion of the sort of yuppie, higher educated. But here was the thing. When gas a couple of summers ago went to $4, I finally started to hear people wondering, why don't we grow more of our own food? If not my yard, at least somewhere. You know, why don't we have more farmers? How is it economically sensible to fly this stuff in from Brazil or Chile or wherever the hell this stuff comes from? Would it be better for, Farmer Jones down the road to grow the damn tomatoes? Never mind growing some tomatoes in my yard. And if there's an upside to $100-plus dollar oil and $4 gas, is it's going to make people think of that, even just running out to the supermarket. I mean, I think about that now, especially when I'm driving the big vehicle that gets 12 miles to the gallon. That if, just running out to Walmart or the supermarket for some little dinky item, it could be an $8 trip.
Exactly. And I think that we're seeing, and I'm not a big foil hat guy, so on the peak oil stuff, I look at peak oil as something that we're going to eventually face. I don't know when, I don't know exactly what it's going to look like, but there's only so much in the ground and we're burning it, so sooner or later we have to reach a point where we can't just keep sucking more and burning more. We have kind of a point that we level out. And recently, as part of this whole WikiLeaks thing, this thing came out with a top geologist in Saudi Arabia admitting to the U.S. government and going, yeah, we've been lying. We can't really do what we say we can do. I think that as we see, so it's not really more of a like peak oil question, but just like your thoughts as at the economic level, the more it costs for our energy, the more I see people taking this step backwards. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, that's the economist in me too. When you make people think about it, and what makes them think about it is the money that makes them think about it. They'll think about the Prius versus the Suburban when gas is $4.75 a gallon. You know, when gas is $2.75 or $1.75, they're going to drive a Suburban. I would.
Well, remember the good old days when it was 96 cents. That was,
yeah,
you know.
I'm older than you.
And we can, well, I know, you know, we could go back further, but I'm not talking about that long ago, right? I'm talking.
No, '90s.
It was under a buck. At least it was down in Houston. I went down to Houston back in like 96, and I think gas down there was like 88 cents at one gas station. And we've come a lot. When we look back, you say, well, in 1970, how much gas was. That sounds like a long time ago. 1996 wasn't that long ago.
No, here's the thing. I mean, for all my, because I can be kind of, well, I think you know my the show that I'm on in London all the time. My nickname, the Prince of Darkness. That's which I'm still not sure if I like that. That's how they throw at me when it's my turn.
I like
that's
it.
How they throw to me, you know. So, what is our the Prince of Darkness over in the U.S. think about this? But the fact is, humans are amazing. We will innovate ourselves out of this. The peak oil, who cares? You know what? We'll have cars that run on string beams, you know, because that we could figure that out. But we're not going to figure it out if we don't have to. It's cheaper to pull oil out of the ground right now. And you know, but what I worry about is these knee-jerk political decisions. The BP oil spill in the Gulf, boom, we freeze all offshore drilling. Whoa.
Yeah, that's insane to me because the innovation requires the energy that we're getting from the oil now to make the innovation so that we can get the energy from something else.
But that's why, you know, maybe we shouldn't do deep water drilling. I don't know. But to make a decision like just like that, I would hope more thought would go into, you know, suspending a kid from school than went into, like, whether or not we should, you know, maybe we shouldn't have it. I don't know. But damn it, some smart people should think about it before you make a decision like that.
Agreed.
And now Japan with the nuclear plants, I don't know if Americans know it. I think the number, if it's important, look it up. I think it's 104 operating nuclear reactors in this country. And I just saw a story, there's two somewhere in Texas where they were in the process of getting ready to add two more reactors. And there's already pushback on whether or not to let the two new reactors go forward. But here's the problem, and you and I have not talked about this. My dad worked for the utility here in New England for 40 years, and as a summer job, I spent two summers working shutdown in a nuclear plant. So I've worked inside nuclear power plants, which I'm not even advocating for them, but this is the political part of it. 104 reactors all built in the last 40 years. Really, no new ones coming online. Over the next 40 years, they're all going to have to be decommissioned. They right now produce 25% of all the electricity in the United States. In order to just stay even, we need two new reactors over two every year, starting right now, just to maintain the level of nuclear power that we currently make. And of course, everyone's wringing their hands, oh, Japan, tsunamis.
Yeah.
You know,
I guess my response to that is, you know, like one of the places they want to add this reactor is down in Hood County, Texas. And I'm not real worried about tsunamis in the middle of the Texas plains. So I understand it. And I also understand that, like, if those reactors in Japan were modern reactors, we'd be having a hell of a lot less of a problem right now. They're 40-year-old technology. And then I guess the other nightmare scenario I see out of what you're telling me is, okay, so we keep punting, just like we've done with the economics. We're going to punt with energy.
Right.
And you say these things have to be decommissioned. Well, here's what's going to happen. Out of what you just told me, here's what I see anyway. We're going to get to the point where we need to decommission them, and we're going to know we can't because we need the energy. Well, then we need to put new plants in. Well, we can't because we didn't do it, and now it takes too long. So we're going to end up at a point where we're going to have plants that should have been shut down, and we're going to have no choice but to keep them running.
Right, held together by rubber bands and chewing gum.
Awesome. That's a great thing to hold plutonium together with.
Well, you know what's funny, too? I saw somebody made a really good point recently in some news story I was watching on television about, like, the angst over nuclear energy. I think, do you know the number of what percentage of our power is generated with coal? Isn't it in the order of, like, 50?
It's over 50%. It's like 54 or 57 or something like that.
Didn't we just have 29 miners die in West Virginia last year in a coal mine?
Absolutely.
You know?
And another interesting fact, if you live within 50 miles of a coal generation power plant, you get more radiation off, you know, just off radiation, background radiation from a coal plant than if you live 50 miles from a nuclear plant. Now, of course, if the coal plant blows up, okay, yeah, we don't have Chernobyl, but I'm staying on a day-to-day operations. The coal plant produces more radiation than a nuclear plant does that actually gets out into the atmosphere.
Well, right, and never mind the green, you know, for the people with their panties in a bunch over greenhouse gases, which is fine. I don't want greenhouse gases. But, I mean, you got to pick a lane and drive in it here, you know? Pick a fight. You can just, I don't get it. It just, if somebody had a clean sheet of paper and was making a plan, and the plan that somebody came up with was the one that we're currently doing, they think it was the stupidest idea ever. Like, how the hell did you think this up?
Yeah.
You know
what I'd love to do someday is get you and Chris Martinson on here for a roundtable conversation. I think that would be absolutely awesome. Maybe I can make that happen. I don't know if you're familiar with Chris and his work, but it's really, really deep into the economic side of power production and energy and things like that. I think you guys would like each other.
Okay. I figured you were setting us up to have a fist fight, but that's all right.
No. Actually, I think there'd be a lot of collaboration here, because he has a lot of the facts that go deeper into, like, the statistics and stuff that you're bringing up, and how short we are going to be on energy if we don't do something. And I'm kind of with you. I'm like, you know, we will fix this, but it's a matter of how much trouble we'll create in the interim, because we're not getting serious about it, because, like you're talking about, we can't replace 25% of our energy overnight. We just can't do it. And we can't not use it either. The system's not set up to run that way. Turning off light bulbs aren't going to do it. We could turn off Madison Avenue, and it's not going to fix the real problem with our needs for energy. And we got to do something until we come up with these other technologies. And then these idiots do stuff like, I don't know if you remember this, but back about, guys, it's like 3 or 4 years ago now. Schwarzenegger out of California was finally like, we're going to build the biggest solar plant, energy farm ever that's ever been done, and we're going to put these solar panels out in the middle of the desert where they can't possibly offend anybody. And Feinstein and Boxer blocked it because it would interfere with the habitat of the desert animals to have a solar panel. And Schwarzenegger, who I'm not a fan of, but to his credit, said, if I can't put solar panels in the desert, where the hell can I put them? And, of course, now you know where they're going to put them now, right? They're going to put them where they destroyed all the land by turning the water off. Because the land's not, now they got a new desert. So the man-made desert gets the solar panels. And I see real energy crisis issues, I guess, coming. And I don't know. I know I bring you on this show. When you hear crisis out of me, you're thinking off the end of the earth. I just mean the cost of living and the availability of certain resources.
Right, and it's all going to just continue to escalate, and that's when the innovation happens. The economics of it is just, it's always inescapable. When one method is not working, then that's when somebody makes a better mousetrap. You know, people have escaped from Alcatraz, we've landed men on the moon, we'll figure this stuff out. And, you know, but there's no need to. We haven't needed to.
What are some of the things you think people should do, you know, from your viewpoint? Because you come at this prepper stuff a little bit different than I do. I come at it the way you come at economics, right? I analyze it. I come up with systems. I come up with formulas. You're coming at it sort of like I started, because I came out of the Northeast just like you, and we prepared because it was going to be cold. So what do you think is just an average guy that's out there, you know, doing this stuff in practice that the average person could be doing right now, so that as this change happens, they're better equipped to deal with it?
Well, I mean, as much as modern life allows you to remove yourself from being that dependent. Now, you know, I don't like those curly Q light bulbs either, but they do really use a lot less energy. So, you know, anything that makes you less dependent. I mean, we're not all switching to candles. Not everyone has, you know, endless amounts of firewood to heat their homes with wood. You know, but there are pellet stoves. There's other things. And the preparedness part too. I was the one lecturing about not getting too hardcore and overboard in anything. But it's good to have, you know, some food and some supplies and some candles. And I don't know why anybody in America shouldn't have a generator, for God's sakes. You know, because I don't care where you are. Hurricanes, ice storms, whatever. You can lose your damn power.
And they're pretty cheap right now. In the middle of a hurricane, they're really expensive.
Just like iodine pills like this morning, too, right?
Exactly.
If you're an American buying iodine pills right now, you know, go slam your fingers in a door somewhere, because it's like it's a smarter thing to do. But was that out loud?
Nah, it was fine, because if you heard some of my my episodes recently on that subject, I think we're insane. I'm glad somebody else is saying it. Especially on my show, that's great. But I mean, food storage. What do you think? I mean, if somebody was, it wasn't me. It was just like a guy that you were talking to that knew you from the business world and found out about this part of your life and said, "Well, yeah, you've sold me on this. How much food should I have at least stored in my home? You know, what's kind of some minimums that you, from your viewpoint?"
I don't necessarily measure like how many days. I know I have well in excess of a month's worth of food. And the thing is, as much as freeze-dried and all these other sort of like, you know, bags of rice, the truth of the matter is if you keep it in a, if they're clean and in a fairly dry, cool area, standard canned goods from a supermarket can, I've heard stories about lasting decades perfectly fine. As long as they're not dented, rusting, and whatnot. I mean, so, you know, it's just some canned vegetables, some Dinty Moore stew, just people, I think people are overwhelmed with the idea to the point where they're frozen into inaction. They don't know what to do, so they don't do anything. Well, do something, you know, a few cans of soup, man, some carrots, you know, some powdered milk, some couple gallons of water, you know, something, you know, some candles, just in case. I mean, for $100, you could probably put a month's worth of food together, for God's sakes.
I think you could. It might not be the most tasty food you've ever eaten, but I think you can go really far in $100. We did a project with just two five-gallon pails of randomly stored food, and I think we ended up cramming about $50 worth of stuff in there, and it was roughly 3 weeks' worth of food for two adults. And that's a start, right?
Hey, my supermarket, I just bought some, is a tuna fish, a brand name, Bumblebee, something, Starkist, $10 for $10.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's good to have a guy like you on where I can talk about these high-level economic issues, and you don't think we're nuts because we do something that our grandparents did.
There's a lot to be said for that. You know, I go back. People think the Victory Garden is just some show on PBS now that I was making fun of the public television. But, you know, that came out of World War II when so many of our resources were going to fight the war. That's when FDR started that whole, you know, every American, it's patriotic to do so, to have a garden, a Victory Garden in your yard. So you can grow some of your own food, so we'll all have plenty of food. And that was that's where the nickname came from, Victory Garden, It is patriotic. It's what you're supposed to do. We should not just think that, like, children shouldn't think food comes from a supermarket. Kids should know where food comes from.
Well, guys, you hear that? That's the reason that I brought a guy like Mike on the show right there, because of things like that. And I hope that there's more and more people coming to this realization. Kind of finishing up with you, I'd like your thoughts on this. I was watching this video on YouTube today. I'll email you the channel for these folks. I just found them. They're called like the Urban Farming Guys or something like that, but they're going into like it's this tore up part of Kansas City. I mean, it's like as bad as like 8 Mile Detroit or something like that. And they're like five or six of them. They all bought houses next to each other. They're putting like little urban farms, aquaponic systems. They bought an old school they're restoring. And one of their points was not just growing food and teaching other people how to do it, but that there could be a really positive economic impact if people would go back to this concept of not blowing everything you have, but also just starting to grow local food again. I think there's room for economic growth in this country there, and at least it would be based on something. What do you think?
How could it be bad? What is wrong with that? It's just, it's wholesome. It's appropriate. The land, it's better than growing just grass on it. Or, it's just, I'm shocked that people find this, I don't know, like newsworthy even. It's nice that they're doing it, but I mean, this is what we used to do. I mean, up until literally the last 50 years. That's when everything changed. Everything changed really that way in the last 50 years. It was always appropriate to have your own garden, have some chickens, have a cow. And not everybody. If you're living in Brooklyn, you can't do it. But you can have a tomato plant out in the balcony, fire escape, something. You know, everyone can help a little. That will lessen the number of planes coming in from Brazil carrying tomatoes, for God's sakes.
Absolutely, and it'll also make us less dependent on stuff like all the vegetables that are not coming in from Mexico right now, because even though you guys had a lot of snow, we didn't get a lot of snow, but I don't know if you heard, it was like 15 degrees every day for a high the week of the Super Bowl down here. It froze everything.
Yeah.
And these countries that we've relied on to produce for us out of season, it went down into Mexico and southern Florida, places like that, and there's a big produce shortage right now, so I think we could rectify a lot of that. Now, maybe that doesn't, that might mean we're not eating green peppers freshly picked in February, but there's a lot of things we can grow in those colder parts of the year, so I'm completely in sync with you there. Mike, I appreciate having you on the show today. I will have people be able to go by your site, get your newsletter, and things like that. I really hope you guys do that. Hope you enjoyed hearing from Mike today. It's kind of a change up for the show. It takes me back to my Pennsylvania roots whenever I talk to a guy with, I guess, what we call an accent from the South when we have that on. So, Mike, I appreciate you being with us here today on the show, and you're welcome back anytime you'd like to come back.
Always fun, Jack. Thank you, sir.
Hey, Mike, again, thank you for being on the air today. And, folks, with that, this has been Jack Spirko. Today, along with Mike Gazer, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Well, thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Survival Podcast Friday Flashbacks. If you enjoyed today's show, please consider becoming an MSB member. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more. You can also support our show by going to TSPAZ, that's T-S-P-A-Z, TSPAZ.com. Anytime you shop online, and while you'll support us no matter what you buy, you will find over 500 reviews of items I have personally tested and vouch for. And to stay in touch with us and never miss anything, follow our channel or our group on Telegram. You can find links to that and all our social media options. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and check the show notes for any episode.